This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
I'm thrilled to introduce to you our special guest for this evening. Nancy Fund is a visionary in impact investing and the founder of DBL Partners, a venture capital firm that demonstrates how business can drive both financial success and positive social change. Over her career, Nancy has supported groundbreaking companies like Tesla, SolarCity, and Pandora. Her work has earned her numerous accolades, including the 2024 Impact Leadership Award and recognition by Forbes as one of the women 50 over 50 in investments. She continues to be a leader in sustainability, clean energy, and entrepreneurship. Joining Nancy for tonight's discussion is Stephen Morris, the San Francisco Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Stephen leads a team covering the world's largest tech companies and brings years of award-winning journalism experience. He has received some of the industry's most prestigious honors, including being named the UK's Business and Finance Journalist of the Year in 2023 and winning the Gerald Loeb Award for Breaking News in 2024. Please join me in welcoming Nancy Fun and Stephen Morris to the stage.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. It's a real honor and pleasure to be here at UC Davis. It's my first time here, but that's not a surprise. I only moved to California 7 months ago from London, as you may be able to tell from the accent. As mentioned, I run our San Francisco Bureau and oversee our global tech coverage. As you might imagine, it's been a busy few months, but in particular, a busy few weeks. But it's my great pleasure to introduce Nancy today, who was very ably introduced by the dean there. And I just want to echo his thanks for you coming here. I know you do a lot for the university, or the college, sorry. Nancy cut her teeth at San Francisco tech investment bank Hambrecht & Quist before moving to Chase in 1999 when it was acquired. She started an impact investing team there and spun DBL out from JP Morgan in 2008. Now, DBL is an acronym for double bottom line, which means the company is not purely pursuing profits, but making ESG-related improvements through their investments, which really span the globe. And one of the things I want to hear from you today is about some of these, how you came about them, and what you're most proud of. Of particular interest to me, considering what I've had to write about a lot in the last few weeks, is in 2006, she participated in a first-round investment for a scrappy electric vehicle startup run by a South African entrepreneur. A man some of you may have heard a little bit about since, especially in the past few weeks. She was then a board observer at said company Tesla for 4 years, as well as holding an early stake in SpaceX, which we wrote about just today, doing another tender offer in the Financial Times. That won't be in the quiz because it's outside of the period. It's now one of the world's most valuable private companies, as the FT's front page tomorrow will tell you. And her co-founder is still on the board of this company. So I'm sure we'll find some time to get into the various issues surrounding that. Nancy and I are planning to speak for about 40, 45 minutes, and then we'll be delighted to take 50 minutes or more of Q&A, both in the room and to our online audience who this is being streamed to. You will have QR codes in front of you to scan and submit questions, which will come to me via an iPad, hopefully, later on. And you can submit it through the window online as well. But if you have a question and you're having problems, just raise your hand and I'm sure you can shout up to the stage on both of us. So Nancy, let's get started. I think the best place would be for you to talk a little bit about your education, your early years, your career trajectory, how you ended up founding DBL, and you know, a bit about its investment philosophy.
Absolutely. Thank you, Stephen. And thanks to the UC Davis community for inviting me. I am a huge fan of UC Davis, even though I live in the Bay Area, and have just been thrilled to be part of the energy landscape here with Ben and all kinds of great people. For how long?
Yeah, it's been 18 years.
Time flies when you're having fun. So anyway, it's a special treat for me to be here. So in terms of how all of this started in my career, I really do look back. I didn't figure this out until like 10 years ago, but it really started in my family, because my father was an inventor and a patent attorney and really got us all involved in inventions that helped our family, but also I had to proofread patents one summer as a summer job, which was, I think that scared me away from a legal profession, if any of you have ever read a patent. On the other side, my mother was very active in politics and community affairs and the League of Women Voters and went door to door, campaigning for all manner of candidates and dragged me along with her. So those two influences are really who I am today, because at DBL, which stands for Double Bottom Line, we believe that the financial return and the social return can come together and be, rather than one diminishing the other, they can actually enhance each other, and you can make a difference while you're delivering strong returns. And so that's kind of the morsel and the early influences. It was not at all a straight path to turn those influences into DBL. And I would say that I gravitated towards the environment from a very young age. I mean, I've always been interested in the outdoors and hiking and skiing, and so that kind of turned into an interest as I was growing up and seeing some of the threats to water and air definitely piqued my interest. But at the same time, the innovation that I witnessed as a child was also very interesting to me. So I went and worked for the Sierra Club at the same time that I worked at Stanford Medical School doing research on biomedical innovation. And that kind of like sums up again what has been a theme of mine, is that working for the Sierra Club and working on biomedical innovation were not unlike each other. And then I turned that into I went to business school and worked for then Governor Brown as a consultant, writing about the emergence of biotechnology in California and the social implications, and was going to actually have a job doing that for the state. But when Jerry Brown, this was his first time around, when he left, the office that did that kind of study was abolished by the next governor, so I didn't have a job.
And it's a good thing you didn't take a job there then.
Huh?
It's a good thing you didn't take a job there then.
Yeah. I mean, I was very disappointed at the time. Plus, there was a recession, and it was hard to get a job. But then I landed at Intel and really, got my first taste of what technology innovation was, and of course Intel then was a big leader in the field. And so that was kind of what I did, and I was very happy doing it. As Stephen mentioned, I did land at Hamilton Quist, which was one of the early backers of the tech revolution financially, because I needed to move to get a job in the city, because I was getting married and living in Berkeley and the commute was bad. So moving to finance was quite a shock to my system. When I grew up, I didn't even know what a venture capitalist was. So it was not like I dreamed of ever being one, but here I was thrust into that and loved it. This was such a great place to work, such a great time to be in San Francisco, backing tech companies, and so that kind of set me on my way. And my boss, one of the founders of H&Q, Bill Hambrecht, he was on the board of the Sierra Club, so he was like one of the few people that, when I told people that I worked at the Sierra Club, which I hardly ever did in a business environment because no one really cared, he was very pro it, and so that helped me to begin to knit together all the facets of my life. And we actually raised a very early environmental fund in the 90s, early 90s, that was, it was 17 million. That's how tiny it was. And we made some good investments, but it was way too early. People didn't even know what global warming was at that time. So went back into tech investing. And eventually, in that 2000, when we were acquired by Chase and then JP Morgan, began to see, wow, this is the climate impact, or the climate investing opportunity was just beginning to be apparent in the Bay Area, because there were solar companies, Powerlight, which was in Berkeley, SunPower. So we worked with a regional group called the Bay Area Council, which is alive and well today, has an office actually in a boat on right by Pier 9, I think, in the city. But back then it was really a gathering for all the businesses in the region to work on improving the region for business. And so that was the opportunity that presented itself. We had been active members when we were H&Q. They said all that money going into the dot-com companies in that 2000 period wasn't really lifting up the poor neighborhoods in the Bay Area. And so they said, and they worked with community groups who said, you know what, this isn't working. For us, the same old places get the jobs, and our people, our communities are suffering. And so the Bay Area Council said, well, let's get some people to invest in companies in these places and pay attention to place and create jobs for people that maybe couldn't get a job at Intel or Google or whatever, that didn't have the training. And so that was really the way that our impact investing was born, really. We decided, yeah, let's do this. It would show the world that we still cared. Now JP Morgan, cared about the Bay Area, even though our company H&Q had been subsumed into a New York-based international bank. It was a good message to send. And so my boss said, you know, since you've been investing as a VC with us, and you also do all this public policy for us, why don't you just try raising this fund? Because that would mean you, instead of two jobs, you'd have one job.
And this was still inside JP Morgan at this time.
Yeah, we stayed until 2008. The first fund, the Bay Area Equity Fund, that we raised as part of this Bay Area Council project was done at JP Morgan.
And why did you decide to spin out?
I didn't want to spin out at first, because if you look at my resume, I joined H&Q like 83 and I left in 2008. So it's not like I was jumping from job to job. I was very happy where I was, and I didn't really consider myself an entrepreneur, even though I backed entrepreneurs and I loved that whole process. So the thought of spinning out of JP Morgan was not first on my list of what I wanted to do. However, when Jamie Dimon came to be the CEO, of course, which he still is today, he had an approach that was, he wanted to de-risk the firm's investments, and he spun out a lot of the third party, the funds that had third party investors as opposed to using bank money. And so there was a whole, you know, JP Morgan Partners was split out. And so our little fund, which was only 75 million, that first fund, was part of an overall effort that had more to do with JP Morgan as a bank than it did for me. But of course, at the minute we did it, after I was resistant at first, it was like, oh, we should have done this years ago. This is great. Control our own destiny, be able to really lean into our impact and into sustainability. Not that JP Morgan wasn't supportive. It was, and very much give credit to the institution and the folks that helped make that happen.
And since, the fund has grown to manage more than $1 billion, so many multiples of that initial one. Can you explain to me a little bit about how that came about, how you raised money, and then talk about some of the companies that you've invested in that have, you know, you've built your reputation on them, that helped you grow and grow?
Sure. It was very difficult to raise that first fund. It always is a first-time fund. If you get through it, you know, it's one of the hardest things you'll do in your life. But it was particularly hard because, A, people had just lost, by the dot-com boom had by then, the early 2000s, turned into a bust. People had lost a lot of money. VCs were, like, not doing any more internet deals. Investors didn't want any part of it. And then we come around, you know, we're tech people, but also we have this kind of do-gooder. We want to help society. We want to create jobs for lower income people and transform neighborhoods. They were like, please, you know, I just lost all this money. This just doesn't sound good. Because back then, people thought that if you introduced a social priority or a lens into pure financial investing that you would jeopardize your returns. That was a very widely held belief. So it was really hard, and there was no proof otherwise. So it was hard to raise that first fund. But when we made some investments, like Tesla, like SolarCity, like Powerlight, while it took a long time for especially Tesla to turn the corner, we began to see that, you know, jobs were being created in neighborhoods that needed them, and it was sort of becoming, it was coming together. And so in 2008, when we spun out, we were pretty well set to raise our second fund as a standalone. But then September of 2008 happened. We spun out in January, and of course that was a huge financial crisis. And it was like, okay, deja vu all over again. Now people don't like venture capital because their portfolios are hemorrhaging, and we don't, you know, they just didn't want to pay attention to something new. They needed to take care of their own portfolios, and we did too. Our first fund, there were, you know, many near-death experiences at that time for everybody. So we delayed raising that. We eventually raised it in 2010, our second fund, which was double the size, because by then we had had an exit. Powerlight was sold to SunPower. Tesla was actually beginning to get some attention, as was SolarCity, and a non-sustainable investment. An investment outside of sustainability, Pandora, the internet radio company. So that worked. And then by the time we raised our third fund, we showed the results.
But there wasn't a trade-off, right?
Right. Yeah. We were emphatically proving it. And so we had began to attract the more traditional investors. Our early investors had been foundations that were doing this sort of as a quasi grant, a program-related investment, and we had banks, but who wanted the credit for regulatory reasons to invest in low-income neighborhoods. But so now, fast forward, we raised our fourth fund during right at the beginning of COVID, and that was a $600 million fund. We could have raised more, but we just wanted to stop there. So yeah, we've had quite a trajectory.
Yeah. Now, of course, back in 2008. You know, impact ESG-based investing wasn't really a major asset class. It has since exploded. I mean, at the FT, we created an entire team.
Yeah.
Moral Money, Climate Capital.
We have FT for Good.
Yeah, exactly. So we have all of these products. We recognized it early. But it is also true that there has been a bit of a reckoning, a bit of a check to the ambitions. You know, it's fallen out of vogue a little bit. There have been big outflows from the sector. You know, we're talking tens of billions this year. And, you know, people are kind of provocatively asking, especially in light of the election of Donald Trump, who isn't, I would say, the most, you know, the friendliest face to impact investing or environmental causes around the world. They're asking the question in the FT, is ESG dead? You know, are you still optimistic? Is this just a bump in the road?
Well, you know, who is it? Was it Mark Twain? Reports of my death are greatly exaggerated. It feels like we go through this every 3 or 4 years, and we're still here. And the fundamentals of a more diversified, less carbon-intensive economy are more positive than ever. The reduction in the price of solar, of batteries, of wind, and the ability to scale these with interesting financing approaches. So we're so competitive compared to 2004 when we started, where we were not. So I think inexorably we're seeing that, you know, more and more new energy sources are predominantly clean. So I don't, and that happens globally, and I don't think it's going to stop. What we're seeing is, you know, the politicization of some of this, which has always been the case. Remember Solyndra back in the 2010 era that set a lot of things back. But you know, you just pick yourself up and you keep going. And impact is a little different than ESG. Mm. ESG, I view as more of a risk management tool to help you screen out stocks that you know, don't meet your criteria, a way of keeping score. Whereas impact is really embedded in the investment process, and we're looking for companies that do things to improve the world, be that reduce carbon or create more social equity. So it isn't it's not a metric so much as it is a reason for being. And so, there was just a huge conference in Europe that tracks impact, and it's over $1 trillion from, you know, barely anything 20 years ago. So I think that sort of beat keeps going. And with ESG, with the fundamentals being so strong, and importantly, with it being a bipartisan effort now, I think we will, we're all hearing, oh, the IRA may be gutted. I don't think so. I mean, because if you look at, I think it was $200 billion spent across 46 states or something, and over $160 billion of that was in red states.
Yeah.
And I've never met a governor, red, blue, purple, whatever, that doesn't like to talk about the jobs he or she created.
Absolutely,
And there are many of them. There's over 300,000 jobs from the IRA and over 500 new factories. So this is the stuff of politicians' dreams, regardless of what party you're in.
Yeah. When Biden was elected, just 4 short years ago, you spoke to the transition team before he even took office, when he was just president-elect, and they sought your advice on green issues and how best to develop and finance them. I'm wondering if you anticipate a similar call from this transition team.
Well, I'm not holding my breath, but...
And if you did receive such a call, what would you say?
Well,
bearing your audience in mind.
Sure, I'd say... let's keep investing. Let's keep creating jobs. Let's keep transforming neighborhoods. Let's keep onshoring vital industries. And some of these themes are very, very resonant with the Trump administration. I would also point people to the fact that climate mitigation and resilience and adaptation have to happen everywhere, and we do have the technologies to address the growing negative impacts. I mean, we have one company in Alameda called Rain that just did a demo with Lockheed Martin and Sikorsky which is the Blackhawk company, doing an autonomous suppression of a wildfire. Did it 3 times, found the fire, lifted the water out of the river and put out the fire, and made 3 trips perfectly in a way that in a really windy situation, where the CEO of Sikorsky told me if it hadn't been autonomous, if pilots had been flying that helicopter, you would have seen the helicopter go like this, because it just took so much. There's always a delay when humans are adapting all of their reflexes to wind at that speed, whereas the autonomous helicopter just went straight through. So this is really our future. It's something that will help firefighters. We're not threatening firefighters, but getting to these fires before they spread out of control, when they're manageable, will save us so much money, so much habitat, people's lives. And so who doesn't like that? I mean, and who doesn't like, you know, seeing helicopters without pilots putting out fires? I mean, this is cool stuff, and it's vital to these kinds of innovations to protecting our forests and the carbon that they store.
So it's not all doom and gloom. The IRA is not going to be completely gutted, moved out.
I don't think so. From what I'm hearing, and from the fact that much of it has already been, the money has already been allocated, so it's kind of hard to pull that back. Now, of course, there may be focuses on more traditional sources of energy, but this genie is out of the bottle. the move to a clean energy future, to a clean economy across ag and all sectors, not just energy, is here to stay. Plus, it's also international. I mean, if you're a farmer, now you can get paid more. One of our companies, Farmers Business Network, working with ADM or PepsiCo to grow grain with a lower carbon footprint and use data to help you do that. So why is that important? I mean, farmers need to, you need to monetize low carbon ag for farmers because it's a very risky business and they're already, they have all kinds of hurdles in front of them, not to mention weather events. But, you know, lo and behold, now Europe has a regulation that says if you're going to import soybeans, and it will extend to other crops soon, you have to prove that you didn't create deforestation in that. I mean, it was a big regulation, and look at the carbon impact of that as well. So now all of a sudden, these farmers that are able to, you know, trace their crops and look at the carbon footprint through the kind of innovations that this company, Farmers Business Network, and others are creating, gives them a lifeline to sell into Europe. So, you know, even though there are, you know, certain isolationist trends in our midst, to be clear, we our farmers, our businesses depend on a global economy.
Yeah, but it's not just programs or, you know, things like the IRA that people are worried about. There's also a lot of talk about deregulation, downsizing the federal government. I mean, the market's reacted very positively for this. So you're, as a financier and a venture capitalist, you're seeing stock markets go up, you're seeing predictions of a wave of M&A, higher earnings. You know, are there any regulations or departments that you think have been standing in the way of impact? Is there any areas of bureaucracy that you would actually like to see addressed by the new government in a more positive way rather than just sort of negatively shrinking?
Well, I think anyone that has dealt with the government, I mean, there is a certain process that's very often antithetical to entrepreneurs who want to get it done yesterday and like to break things and, you know, have sharp elbows. So there needs to be some kind of give and take there and understanding where the various groups come from. I would say that certainly some of the red tape, some of the regulation, there's no doubt that we could skim some of that off the top and be more efficient. I don't know what, you know, how bad it is. I mean, one example would just be transmission development, which is vital to allowing us to ship, to grow renewables and send it from one region to another. And I mean, I think that's an example of where we've gotten in our way a bit. I mean, between the FERC, the federal agency, the regional squabbles, the state, the role of states, enviro groups. I mean, it's just, it's taken way too long to build some of this infrastructure. And yeah, we could, if we figured out a way to get around that, it would be a good thing. So, I mean, I think there are pockets where we could do a better job. We certainly don't want to gut very important environmental laws that we have worked hard over the past several decades to pass. But that's very hard to do. So
yeah,
I'm not afraid of that.
So you mentioned earlier on, you made two early investments that you're very well known for, Tesla and SpaceX. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually know Jamie Dimon let an early investment in Tesla slip between his fingers, but he must be kind of regretting that a bit now.
Well, there's a story there, but I think I might have to retire and write a book about it someday.
Okay, well, you can give an exclusive to the FT as soon as you're out
of
the field.
Of course.
Okay, I've got your mobile. So you said in an interview last year that you would still invest in Tesla, even today, you know, when it's worth a lot more, if you still had the chance. There are predictions about this company, which has, you know, had a real shot in the arm, you know, since Trump's election a couple of weeks ago, that it could be a $1 trillion company or even more than that.
I think it is already.
Yeah. So you go from trillion dollar to $5 trillion, which is Elon Musk's latest prediction. I mean, can you explain a little bit about how you first got interested in this company and presumably this person as well, and how it kind of fit and still fits within your impact investing framework?
Sure. Well, that just to I'll get to that. Let me just, the $1 trillion to $5 trillion, that's always been in the sights of the Tesla narrative. Mm. Because it isn't, I mean, while cars and transportation are fundamentally important and are huge markets, the fact that we led, that Tesla led in batteries and then extended that to stationary storage and brought in SolarCity with the ability to combine those two, that takes you, that's like not just the car industry, that's like all the utilities or, you know, GE, or I mean, it's, mm-hmm. And so if you added up all those valuations of those other kinds of companies, you could easily get to $5 trillion. Mm. And I think that is what people mean when they say that there is so much more upside in Tesla because of the growing dissemination of its technology across other segments, and then layer on the autonomy part of it. It has fundamental advantages that I think very credibly allow it to be talked about in at those levels. And so, going backwards to that to answer your question about the 2006, why we invested, it really had to do with our mission, and it's a really good learning for people that are becoming investors and are interested in impact. Impact opens your eyes to things that perhaps you wouldn't have looked at. And since we had a responsibility in that first fund to create jobs that weren't tech jobs, and the Ford Foundation, one of our investors, actually gave us a number that we had to hit, which we were terrified about not.
What was the number?
It was, I think it was 750 jobs for lower income people.
In the Bay Area?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's a lot.
And so when we sat down and listened to the Tesla pitch, and this was not when Elon.
No, this would have predated him.
Yeah, this was Martin Eberhard and Mark Darpenning, and Elon was the chairman. We were like, wow, this is cool. I mean, we love electric cars. I mean, because we had a green focus as well as a community impact focus. And then we thought, hey, you know, if a car company grows, don't they hire a lot of people? Isn't it pretty labor intensive compared to a software company? So we thought, we like the mission of unhinging transportation from fossil fuels, and we like the possible job creation in the Bay Area. And so we really worked. So that's kind of how we were able to justify the incredible risk of investing in a car company in Silicon Valley in 2006. I mean, and most people shunned it. But just to reiterate, our mission kind of pushed us a little bit more than other people's, outside of our own comfort zone, but at least we had that belief that we could achieve our goals. And we did, I mean, many, many times over. And we helped the company, you know, find a plant for the Model S, which eventually, when we went through many, many efforts, and that eventually found, of course, the perfect first plant in the Toyota plant in Fremont, which had been shuttered, and thousands of people had lost their jobs years earlier. So this was a great community redevelopment story, in addition to all the other facets of it. So that's kind of how that went, and it was very difficult. Went through the 2008 downturn, and very hard to get investments, and, you know, finally things turned around, and the company went public at a very modest valuation with no real revenues to speak of, car revenues, in 2010. And then along the way, when we had, actually before Tesla, we had, I think, invested in PowerLight, which was one of the first rooftop solar companies in the Bay Area, and that was growing rapidly. It also created a lot of jobs. It was in a lower income neighborhood of Berkeley. So it was all kind of coming together, and we were able to exit Power Light because it was sold to Sun Power pretty, you know, only about 2 years after we invested. So that was a great, great win for us. And that then opened our eyes to SolarCity.
Mm. So you spent 4 years as a board observer at Tesla?
Yeah.
And your co-founder, Ira, is still on the board now.
He is.
Considering I've, you know, promised not to quote anything from this interview, can you, what's Elon Musk like to work with?
Well, I haven't worked with him in a while, but I mean, he's intense. I mean, all those stories that you hear about his work habits are true. And he's dedicated in a fundamental way to improving the human condition. And that takes many, many forms. And you see it in the portfolio of companies that he has. And he's driven and he's, I think all tech kind of innovators have a little bit of perfectionist in them that they want to get it right. They hold themselves to a high standard, and that's him. And he holds other people to that standard as well.
Yeah, I mean, he runs 6 major companies. You know, we'll all have heard of them. You know, SpaceX/Starlink these days, Tesla, you know, Twitter/X, XAI, the Boring Company. You know, and Tesla, as you point out, is now transforming itself into an AI and robotics and autonomy. And then he's added political activism to this as well, you know, trying to solve the federal government and US foreign policy. How does one find the time to do all of this effectively?
I mean, he's obviously, these people are once in a generation. I mean, they just don't exist. I mean, he has an insatiable appetite for change and for excellence, and is inquisitive and also is very talented. I mean, he's a genius in terms of the way that he's able to understand problems. And I mean, unlike most of us, I don't think he needs to sleep as much. I think he, you know, this Elon Musk is not a dawn to dusk type of person. He's, you know, far beyond that. I mean, he works a lot. But on the other hand, he also is able to attract amazingly talented people and help them to be self-directed. And yet he's always, you know, what I hear is that even today, with all of, as you say, all of the responsibilities he has, if he walks into an engineering meeting, he's able to ask the best questions in the room, even though he's doing so many things.
I mean, what everyone will be really interested to hear about as well is, did you ever see this alliance with Donald Trump and this sharp veering to the right wing of his politics coming about? I mean, this man was an outspoken, you know, supporter and funder of the Democrats. And just in the short time that I've been out here, 7 months, as I mentioned before, we've seen a dramatic change in his stance, his activism. And, you know, as the richest person in the world, richest private citizen in the world, and the leader of so many companies, there is a knock-on impact. A lot of people work for these companies and must be looking at what he's doing. Not everyone's going to agree with it. I mean, how do you think this plays out?
I think that I'm just echoing the pieces I read, some of them in the FT. I think ever since COVID, I mean, I think there's been, we've been through difficult times, and I think people have, and Elon is not alone. I mean, we just witnessed an election where we saw a very, you know, very strong result. We have a sweep of all 3 forms of government. And there's an angst out there for sure. And I think that the tech community really, you know, at its fundamental it really is a meritocracy. I mean, people in tech really work hard and they really want to see those that produce, you know, the best outcomes get ahead. And that's kind of the way they're structured. And I think that with all of the fissures in society that we've seen, some people have just gotten disaffected, that, you know, all of our social issues are interfering with our move towards sort of bettering the human condition writ large. And so, you know, that angst you know, for impact investors, you take that angst and you turn it into investment lens, and then that those fissures really become fountainheads for how to build new businesses. And so we see a path as impact investors. It's not as clear for, you know, the kind of the traditional political process, how we get from where we are to toward a more common sense of a purpose.
Mm. Now, you mentioned it briefly. I mean, why, like, you know, a lot of Silicon Valley, you know, which is traditionally, you know, very left-wing, seems to have moved across. Do you think they stand a chance of reshaping Washington?
I mean, I would challenge the notion that it's always been Democratic, because when admittedly I've been at this a long time, but when I started at Intel, all the tech leaders, except for like two that I knew, were either libertarians or Republicans. And so the notion that tech has been all Democratic all the time is just not true. It has gone through phases. And it had been trending much more Democratic, but I never thought of it as so monolithic. I think that it's had more diversity, and what I just described as sort of an overall societal angst pushing us towards less kind of traditionally Democratic approaches, I think you're going to see some flips. And this is one of them in this sector. However, I still think there is a very healthy diversity of a political thought in Silicon Valley. It's you know, some people are more vocal than others.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, it's going to make my life very interesting for at least the next 4 years, or until Musk and Trump fall.
You'll have a lot of fun,
whichever
Stephen.
Is sooner. We've got 15 minutes left, and I promised that we would have 15 minutes for questions, both in the room and from our online audience. So I'm going to read from this iPad here and hopefully not drop it.
And of course, think of your questions as well. We're happy to discuss them.
Okay, this is a good one to start on. What was your most satisfying investment?
Most satisfying investment. Investments are sort of like children. You're not really supposed to favor one over the other. Very satisfied with Tesla and SolarCity,
mm-hmm.
because remember hearkening to my first job out of college, which was for the Sierra Club, turning those interests into the behemoths that those companies became, and the change that they created is very satisfying.
Yeah. Okay. Now this one follows on quite nicely. What are three of the most important aspects of a company, or what are the three most important aspects of a company that you look for when deciding to make an investment?
So remember, we're investing when these companies are tiny. They're just like a few people in many cases, and no one's ever heard of them. So it's kind of, don't think of it as investing in Tesla like the Tesla that you know today. It was unrecognizable. Mm. So you need, a team that is committed, that's smart, that's hardworking, that has vision, that's able to be nimble. It's so much about the people at that stage. So the team, the scope of the opportunity with the product or the service. In terms of venture capital, you need something that may be small now, but has a big market and has a path toward this company has a path toward exploiting that market as opposed to other competitors. So differentiation, moats, things like that. And then the third would be a manageable capital intensity because you can have some capital intensive companies in your portfolio, but you can't have them all be needing capital in large amounts before they actually get to a product. So managing those things.
Okay. And do you find many that fit those three criteria?
Well, we try to. I mean, of course, every deal you go into when you start it, you think it's checks all boxes.
I'm going to ask one that's just come in from Michael Brick, who says, can you compare and contrast how impact works as an investment lens with innovation and disruption that Cathie Wood talks about?
They are related.
Does everyone know who Cathie Wood is? I mean, we're a business school, so probably. Yeah, good.
I may not. Why don't you explain?
So she runs a very large tech optimist fund called ARK Investments, very big proponent of Tesla, and invests in some like really out there stuff with the prospect of making astronomical returns if it comes off. Was that a good description?
Yeah, I think so.
She's also very religious and invests, you know, along those lines as well. Christian.
But she goes later, so we're...
Later stage investment than seed, yeah.
Yeah, course. More like, more public companies. Very much admire her work. So what we do has the same kind of disruption, the same industry reorganization that she's talking about. So there are similarities. We just do it much earlier, and we factor in what the social implications or the environmental dislocations, revolutions might be in our work as well.
Yeah. There's a question about the deals environment from Ellie Novotny. I'm sorry if I pronounced your name wrong there. Given the ongoing bullish market, why aren't more companies taking advantage of favorable conditions to go public? And in the meantime, how do early investors typically seek an exit in such a market?
That's a really good question, because back in 2022, when the market kind of crashed for IPOs, it really hasn't recovered yet. And even though the stock market is booming, and there are, so what happened there is that the investor base for IPOs, when they lost money on some of the crash at that time, there was a flight towards recognizing that companies had to be closer to profitability, that revenue growth on its own, without either being profitable or being on a path that got you profitable pretty quickly, that was a fundamental shift, because especially like back in the H&Q days, I don't think any of our companies were profitable when they went, and they weren't profitable for several years. And so that model has had to be tweaked, because investors, instead of having FOMO, oh, I want to be in the next great story stock and buy the on the IPO, they want more proven performance. And so that funnel is a lot narrower for IPOs. And it's not, I know that there are many companies that we're dealing with where they're transitioning and they're saying, okay, we gotta get to profitability earlier. But for some people it's hard. I mean, because Silicon Valley is really built on a certain model, and so some are able to make that change, and some are having more difficulty. I think it will work itself out, but it's, you know, you can never call when that happens. Mm.
And we're seeing some of the largest and most successful private companies, I'm thinking here of SpaceX, Stripe, decide to stay private for much, much longer and still have this ability to raise enormous sums of money, both from banks, investors, and provide liquidity to their employees through secondaries. I mean, is that a trend?
I think
available to the very top end?
Yeah, or? I think it's available for, you know, top decile kind of companies, because let's face it, it's kind of a hassle to be a public company compared to a private one in terms of all of the regulatory and reporting and all those various functions.
Yeah.
But don't forget the people in the room.
Oh, I think some of these are from the people
in the
room.
They are. Okay.
Yeah, they're coming. They have QR codes that they type them in and they read them.
Got it.
Does anyone want to ask a question themselves, like by putting their hand up? Okay, we'll keep going on here.
Oh, there was one more.
Oh, there. Sorry, I didn't see that. The lights are quite bright. There we go.
Hi. I'm a professor here, and I'm teaching property investing. So obviously, I'm excited to have you come here. My name is Ayako Yasuda. Two questions. One is, how do you plan to make the impact last in your portfolio investments after you sell your investments? So So how do you try to ensure that the new owners keep generating the impact that you already envisioned for your company?
Mm-hmm.
And the related question is, sometimes companies are B Corps before they go public, and they face pressure to prioritize profit over mission, and they stop being B Corps. I guess Etsy comes to my mind as an example. Is private ownership in some way more effective for consistent impact generation, or do you see public ownership can handle consistent dual, double bottom line pursuit of both profits and impact? And how can companies do that?
Well, thank you, and I'm thrilled to hear that you're teaching impact investing. Thank you. Yeah, we've been asked that question about how do you keep impact alive after you're out of the company. We've been asked that since day one. And on a certain level, as venture capitalists, we can't, you know, our job is to help them, to invest them, help them grow, and then let them go public or be acquired. So we don't have that control. But what we have seen over the 20 years is that the culture of impact, which is in those companies often from very early ages because of the fact that they've been working with groups like ours, can be very strong. And so and the people that really make a company tick often come to work for these companies because of the mission, and they are able, there's a premium that these companies have in terms of young people, especially, who want careers that matter. So they value those companies. So there is that secret sauce in terms of keeping that alive. Now, when the founders leave, or if there's a major event, life happens, and so. You're certainly going to, and especially if companies go through troubled times, you're going to see impact perhaps diminish. What we always say is you can't judge just every company. You have a portfolio, and as long as your portfolio is accomplishing this, I mean, some of your portfolio companies will over-index on financial return and under-index on social. Some will be great at both. Some will be better on social and less on return. But in the end, as long as you have a strong performance across that continuum, you know, that's really the best you can do. I mean, we're not miracle workers. And as for B Corps, it's a little bit symptomatic of what I just said, that there are, if you choose to go public, you have to sign up for certain things that in some ways can be make it more difficult to focus as intensely on some of the impact related, especially a lot of the employee benefits and things like that. So, but there are successful examples, and I do think that B Corps are one of many ways to demonstrate impact. So they're fine for a group of companies, but you don't have to think that you can't be impact without being a B Corp. You can.
I'm asked one more from, it's anonymous, so I don't know whether it's in the room or online. It's about AI. We can't do an interview in 24 in California without talking about AI. Do you see any parallels between the current AI boom and the dot-com boom, especially in terms of investment opportunities or market risks? I want to broaden that out and say, as a secondary question, do you see any impact opportunities within AI, and are you looking at any of these?
In our business, there is a little bit of a herd mentality. And so if something gets popular, all of a sudden everyone's doing it, and it's dot-com, AI, it just happens. And so we are definitely in that moment. At the same time, it's one of, if not the most fundamental development that has come around in many years. So it needs to be taken seriously. But is it the object of huge attention right now? And will that go up and down yet. Yeah, I mean, yeah. It's kind of the goes with the territory. We're looking at it. I think there are opportunities on an impact side of things. We're looking at a company right now, for example, so I can't name it because we haven't decided, but we're very impressed. You know, all of the data farm, the servers and such that are required take a lot of energy, they take a lot of water, and there are different ways to, in terms of cooling the servers and such, that are required to allow AI, the computers, to crunch as much as they need to crunch in an AI setting. There are some interesting technologies that are allowing better energy management and better water management, so that we don't end up turning the computing needs of AI into a massive climate problem. Mm.
You should put them in contact with us. We're writing about this at the moment.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is very near term, and as soon as
I don't want to drive the price up though before you invest. we've got a couple more minutes. I'm not sure who asked this question as well, because it is anonymous too, but whoever they are could be a journalist, because it's very punchy. Elon Musk has expressed concern about the environment, but Trump does not think it's an issue. How long till this alliance self-destructs?
Oh, boy. I mean, I look at the Trump administration last time, and I mean, there was a lot of churn. I mean, let's be honest. And those are two strong-willed individuals. I do think that, you know, you've heard Trump be more open to electric vehicles because of Elon's influence. Trump doesn't like wind, but I think he likes solar, and there was a lot of solar installed in the first administration. So some of this, you know, like anything in politics, during a campaign, you know, everyone hates, you know, it feels in the debates, they're all going after each other, and then, you know, once it's over, they're all like friends. So, yeah. I mean, it just feels like some of this is theater, and yet there will, you know, realistically, the Trump administration will not be a static one. We'll see all kinds of change, and Elon, you know, we'll just see what happens.
Yeah. Okay. Since you've been so generous with your time and your thoughts, I'm going to give you the last word, because we've reached the end of our allocated time here. We've got lots of promising young students here and their professors from UC Davis. So, what advice would you give to them, like, as they embark on their careers? Yeah, from the experience that you've had?
The advice I would give is to really lean into what you're passionate about. And even if you think that it's not part of a career, you know, like you like hiking or skiing, or you like the outdoors, or you like music, I would just keep yourself open to finding jobs that in a very broad way allow you to pursue some of that passion. I mean, that's what I did. I mean, it went up and down. I mean, my love of nature and the outdoors, there were years where it didn't have anything to do with my job, but it still became, I still kept it as part of who I was. And eventually, the pieces of the puzzle came together and allowed me to pursue something that I felt passionate about. That's going to look different for each person. Impact, I would argue, is a way for you to bring those parts of yourself together. But there are other ways as well. And just be open and remind yourself that you're in for the long haul, and that perhaps you don't think at a particular moment that you're embodying everything you can be. But just be patient, and if you keep that North Star of what it is that's important to you, you'll get to a place that's incredibly satisfying and that can help make your life impact the world around you in a positive way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.